Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Lynn Cherry. Cherry is the author and or illustrator of over 30 award-winning books which teach children about environmental concerns, ecology, and history. Her books include the rainforest classic, The Great Kapok Tree, A River Ran Wild, and her most recent, The Sea, the Storm, and the Mangrove Tangle. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thanks.
Listen, so many of your themes are focused on the environment and saving the land and cleaning up rivers. What brought you so passionately to these subjects?
I actually wrote an autobiography about this because it's the question that I get asked most continuously from kids and parents, everybody. What happened is when I was a little kid, we had a woods behind our house. And it's where I spent most of my waking hours when I wasn't in school. And for me, that was a community. It was a community of animals and, you know, organisms in the creek. And I came home from school one day, and they were bulldozing it.
Oh.
And they just destroyed it. And as a child, you can imagine what a traumatic experience that was.
Mm.
And I just thought that something was wrong with the world if people could just come and destroy something so beautiful and so full of life. And I couldn't go to school for a while. I mean, I was really mourning this place, but then you know how time heals your wounds, and I didn't think about it as much. But then when I grew up and I started reading about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, it was as if it just hit that nerve,
mm-hmm.
you know, this well of pain and mourning, mm-hmm. and I thought, this is even more egregious because of all the species of animals and plants in the rainforest, you know, what we're destroying, you know, all the biodiversity and
mm-hmm.
The
so
connection.
The seed had been planted from childhood that you were going to become some kind of an activist. I understand from your website that you started drawing and writing at the age of 7.
Yeah, probably earlier. That's just what I remember.
Uh-huh. Well, do you remember the first thing you ever wrote?
Well, I have these little books that I kept in a little Whitman's chocolate box. And there's one called Kitty's Adventures. And in fact, in that autobiography, it's called Making a Difference in the World.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of the pictures from, I have a lot of these books, you know, a lot of the covers of these books and pictures from those little books that I did as a child.
Uh-huh. And I understand your mother was an illustrator as well. And is she the one that inspired you to actually turn this into a profession?
Well, yeah, I have to say I was greatly inspired by her. She was an illustrator before she had the three of us. And then she gave it all up for, you know, and raised us. And she used to illustrate Jack and Jill magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then when I went to college and I got some illustration work, she got the idea of starting to do some work herself. And by the time I was out of school and getting books, she had put together a portfolio, and I brought her portfolio around for her, and she started getting children's books. So I was actually able to have her follow in my footsteps. You know, initially I followed in hers, and then
That's
as a children's
great.
Book illustrator, she followed
Full
in
circle.
Mine. Yeah, she's still very much illustrating. I mean, she did some great books, history, The Floating House, and Warm as Wool. And
uh-huh.
my favorite of hers is The Real Tooth Fairy.
Nice. Oh, mm-hmm. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
You lecture to children a lot and try to get children involved in activism and become trying to get them to become passionate about stuff. Why have you focused on children continuously?
I feel that I'm an advocate for children. I mean, they're my audience, and they're so innocent, and they're so trusting. And like, for instance, I was thinking the other day about global climate change and how we're changing the whole, you know, the whole global climate, and how this is going to affect especially coastal areas with sea level rise. And then after the tsunami, how there was a lot of damage from this, you know, the wave, but also then in Florida, this damage from the hurricanes, which mm-hmm. we know are going to be more and more frequent with global climate change. So this is a world we're giving to our children. And I feel so personally guilty that I want to try and help them deal with it. So before I do a book, I think, well, what kind of a book can I do that's going to be about an issue that kids can actually do something that mm-hmm. will help them to cope with the world that they're inheriting? And to change things too. But my books are always so, you know, at least they might have you know, kind of a traumatic traumatic middle part, but then the end is always a resolution, a happy mm-hmm. resolution. Mm-hmm. Kids' books, you know, have to end with hope, I think, and so do the projects that I suggest kids do. They always, I think, have hopeful, possibly hopeful resolutions. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, with the Sea, the Storm, and the Mangrove Tangle, I wrote that because here's a way that kids can learn about mangroves. They can go out and they can plant and restore and protect existing mangroves, and hence protect the coastal areas of Florida where they live. So this has real, very important real-world applications. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
It's a lovely book, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Beautiful illustrations. I really recommend that teachers and parents get that and read it to their children.
Oh, thanks a lot.
When you decide to take on issues, How do you do that? Do you travel to places? Are you constantly reading about environmental concerns? Or,
well, it's funny. What happens is these issues find me. Mm. So I'll do a book, and then because the book appeals to people who are generally going to be concerned about the world, they end up getting in touch with me, writing to me. Kids write to me, and I have to answer questions like, well, what can I do? So I felt that it was my responsibility to find out what they could do and give them some positive suggestions. So when I wrote The Great Kapok Tree, everyone wanted to know, well, how can I save rainforests? And so I went to Monteverde. I checked out a lot of the different rainforest, saving the rainforest projects, and I found this one in Monteverde, the International Forest of the Children, or Bosque Eterno de los Niños, was really reputable, and they were saving land, and they were expanding into some of the farms that had been rainforest once before, and they've just saved a tremendous amount of land, and kids have raised funds to save over 40,000 acres there. So that's pretty exciting.
Remarkable.
Yeah. So there, I try to pick projects that where the kids really will have some success, and they'll be encouraged to continue making a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. You've been doing this for a good number of years. Have you had children grown up come back to you and say that you had inspired them to become adult activists?
Well, finally, you know, because the Great Kapok Tree came out in 1990, so kids were still, you know, anyone who would have read it had to wait a little while. Mm-hmm. But now that is what's happening, and it's very exciting. I'll go to a book signing, and there'll be college kids or high school kids who are saying, I'm going to become a biologist because of your books, or,
wow,
or I'm working to save the environment because of reading this Great Kapok Tree when I was in fourth grade. So to tell you the truth, I didn't know whether the books were having an effect.
Mm-hmm.
All I had was hearsay, teachers telling me, well, yeah, it really moves kids, it matters to them. But it's the kids now grown up coming to me and telling me themselves that has made me even more committed to continuing to write and illustrate these kinds of books.
Mm-hmm. I think kids do need inspiration nowadays. Mm-hmm. Schools are losing funding. Creative education is going out the window. So books are the things that are still there. And
yeah,
it's probably one of the better ways still to be able to communicate.
And these programs that go along with the books. Like, what's really exciting to me is there's, even with the standards, that there are this way of teaching where you use literature as a takeoff point. And then a lot of teachers will be using, say, one theme to teach throughout the whole year. So, for instance, bird migration will be a third grade overarching theme. And then under that, they teach math, science, social studies, geography, everything, you know, ecology, everything they need to.
Mm-hmm.
Rivers. I've been to schools where rivers is the whole theme of the year. They go out, they study their local river, they do water quality testing on it. If the water is dirty, they write letters to politicians. They're learning civics, they're learning writing, they actually do public speaking. They go on radio shows and talk to people, or TV. And so it's real world. So it's relevant. And what they found with every one of these classes where they're being taught this way, because their education is relevant, the test scores go up.
Yeah, I would believe that.
Because it relates to their,
yeah, just
the real
trying to
world.
Hammer in facts and figures and stuff just does not work. I work in the schools every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it. I've seen how these tests, I mean, the kids are just bored.
They're deadening.
By it. Yeah. Yeah, and creativity can't come out for the teachers either. They're, all year, it's mm-hmm. the focus is on these tests. So
yeah.
something bad has happened in yeah. the education systems.
Yeah, but if all teacher needs is to be a little bit creative, and this is really so easy. I was in Princeton, New Jersey at the school. We were laying out transects, measuring square yards, then with a magnifying glass looking and seeing what was in that grass, and then doing a census of what was there. And this woman, the teacher, had the standardized test, the bullets that she needed to be teaching, and she's just checking them off. She's saying, this is so great. This is making my life so easy. So I think teachers, you know, they don't realize how easy it is for them to do.
Turn into a creative
yeah,
cycle
yeah.
you know, with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Do you pick subject first and then write the story, or do you start doing drawings? I've always been curious about that.
No, I definitely write the story.
You write the story first?
Except with the armadillo from Amarillo.
I love that title.
So did I.
That's about geography, right?
Yeah, that is. And I thought of the title, and then I had to write the book. And I didn't know what it was going to be about at first, but it's sort of like Powers of Ten, where the armadillo goes up and up and up from the surface of the earth, just, you know, wants to discover where in the world am I, gets on the back of an eagle, they go up into space, and get it, hook up with a space shuttle. I had to use the space shuttle because a friend of mine an elementary school friend of mine always wanted to be an astronaut, and she actually became an astronaut. So she sent me some of those pictures that I use for reference in the book.
Huh.
Yeah, but
yeah, that's
yeah.
a great book.
Oh, thanks.
So you write the story and then you do the illustrations. Do you actually?
Right.
I've seen pictures of you in your books and on your website where you're actually, like, on location. Do you always go on location, or do you sometimes illustrate from photographs?
Yeah, for Flute's Journey, I went up in a tree. There's a picture of me looking into a nest. And for the Great Kapok Tree, I went to Brazil. And for the Shaman's Apprentice, I went to Suriname, and I lived with a Tirio Indian tribe, a primitive Ooh. Indian tribe. It was so amazing. It was living with people, living almost like going back in time, you know, living with our predecessors, mm-hmm. I mean, our ancestors, right? Yeah, living with people how we used to be.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is illustrator and children's book author Lynn Cherry. You know, I wanted to ask you, besides working on books and working in classrooms with children, how do you yourself focus as a conservationist and as an activist? Do you lobby politicians? What do you do?
I do lobby. In fact, I was down in Washington just 2 weeks ago lobbying for protection of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You know, so they're mm-hmm. trying to, you know, lobbying against drilling. And I could be lobbying every day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In fact, that's the hardest thing, I think, with life as you get older, that how do you spend your time? There's so much to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you lobby? Do I write and illustrate my books? Do I do media interviews? Do I go and roll around in nature, you know, just enjoy the natural world, because you have to do that too?
Mm-hmm. But you never sit in a corner and just get scared about stuff, right?
And
not be proactive.
That's what they're depending upon.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, no, you have to, you just have to try. You just have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, that drilling in the refuge is just unbelievable. And then they're saying that it's not going to do anything, decimate the animals or anything. It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible propaganda to say stuff like that.
It's all doublespeak.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is. What do you actually say to people who still scoff at environmentalists and say we're all tree huggers and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've
had a lot of experience because I go all over the country and speak, and you know, it's all different audiences, and they're not environmentalists, most of them. In fact, they're, you know, people at nature centers or the general public and teachers, and so I do get challenged a lot. I never, when I go out west, I don't use the E word, you know, environment. I talk about saving God's creation. I know, I try and figure out where they're coming from, and I speak their language. And I think we're all talking about the same thing. I mean, after all, I mean, we're talking about our natural treasures, you know, the beautiful natural world that we all love, that sustains us in so many ways, that we all can't live without. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all human beings. We breathe the same air and drink water. And I think that if you can just reduce it to that, and also, I often talk about the health of their children, and that's something that every parent is really concerned about. And every parent knows that environmental degradation is very bad for their children's health. And so that's another thing I mentioned, depending on the area I'm in, you know, what are the issues in that community.
Mm-hmm. So you travel a lot with a message.
I travel a lot I try and inspire.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. I know when I get demoralized, it just saps all my energy. So I have to somehow stay optimistic. Kids make me optimistic because, well, I have a niece and nephew, you know, they're young, three and six, and I just feel like I have to go out there and try and make this world the best I can for them, mm-hmm. that I owe it to them. Mm-hmm. You know, Severin Suzuki went to the Rio conference, and she actually addressed the entire Rio conference, and she asked, "Are we even on your list of priorities?" That's what she asked the kids. I mean, that's what she told the delegates to mm-hmm. the conference. Mm-hmm. And she said she represented the world's children. So
wow.
I got actually inspired by her and thought, someone's got to represent the world's children.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you wrote your autobiography at a fairly young age. What inspired you to write that so early?
Everywhere I go, people ask the same question, so now I can just say, here, read this.
You didn't want to just have a frequently asked questions page on your website.
No. Well, the other thing was, my father was terminally ill, and I just knew he would get such a kick out of it. And I wanted to get it done before he left. So it's, you know, it's sort of a...
It's called Making a Difference, right?
It's called Making a Difference, yeah. And it shows how I became who I am. And part of it was my experience with him when I was a kid, planting trees and getting connected to nature. I think that's the biggest thing with people who have this connection to the natural world, is that they had it as a child, they went out in the woods, they bonded with nature. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. In fact, for really young kids, up until third grade, I'd say don't even talk about environmental issues. Yeah, recycling, you know, but nothing that's going to get kids upset. Just bring them out in the woods and have them experience the beauty and the wonder of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You're an artist in residence at many different places like the Smithsonian and here at Cornell. What do you do during some of those terms?
Well, it's like having a studio, you know, because I don't like working at home. I like working in a community. And so my first one was at the Smithsonian, and I worked in the botany department, and then I wrote How Groundhog's Garden Grew and used them as resources. And I was at Princeton, and I was working on a book on climate change when I was there.
Mm.
And then here I'm working on a book on the ivory bill, because I'm at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And it's not just about the ivory bill per se, it's about the ivory bill habitat. Without the habitat, we would have no ivory bill at all.
Mm-hmm.
And as it is, so little of that habitat was preserved that it's amazing that the bird isn't extinct. But
And that's going to be a children's book as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I hope to go down to Arkansas and help with the search over the winter. And then another book is about citizen science, and the Lab of Ornithology is just doing terrific things with involving kids in collecting scientific data, which is fun because it's just like counting the birds at your bird feeder or mm-hmm. seeing which ones have finch eye disease or whatever, and then getting this data back to the scientists, and they can use it to learn about the world. Citizen science. So I'm writing a book about a lot of the different programs at Cornell and other programs like Journey North. And there's actually a lot of them. They're on my website.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you go into the classroom and talk to children and teachers, are you encouraging them to do projects after you leave and to experiment mm-hmm. with building gardens is something that I think you mentioned.
Yeah. I do heavily promote planting a garden because I think that for kids who are cut off from the natural world, that if they can just go outside of their door in the schoolyard and then be planting vegetables and creating bird habitat and having a nice quiet place to sit in nature right there at school, basically the school becomes the nature center. They don't have to get on a bus and go somewhere, that's going to be that connection. And plus, if you want to teach science, it's just like a science lab.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a way to get kids interested in science, because so many kids go, oh, when they hear the word science.
Oh.
But it's so fascinating if they can relate it to their real life.
It is. In fact, I have a slide in my presentation of this school that put in a big wetland pond in their schoolyard, and it's so beautiful. And this turtle found it, and the turtle actually laid eggs in their schoolyard.
Wow.
And they named her Tess, and she had all these babies, and then there are little turtles running around. I mean, what better science project, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like that. It's just the schoolyard. This one in Virginia I went to, just this woman, Beth Reese, just spent a lot of time making this into a beautiful schoolyard and part of the curriculum.
It's also a good way to teach kids how to treat animals with kindness.
Yes, and they learn responsibility.
Because they do need to learn that.
Yes, they do.
They oftentimes think animals are their toys.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it in classrooms.
And gardens, you know, where they have to care for it. Uh-huh. You have to tend the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
it's a living thing.
Yeah. Those are good things.
Yeah.
And then there's some schools where they actually eat the vegetables that they plant, and then that gets to be part of the school lunch program, and then they're learning about nutrition, and so they're learning to eat better. And anyone who's eaten a really fresh tomato or, you know, beautiful fresh vegetables know that don't resemble the supermarket variety, except maybe Green Star.
Have you gone around to some of the schools in our area?
No, I haven't been here long enough.
Ah, so maybe that'll be something in your future.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Because I a lot of the schools that do have little nature situations going on, little gardens I've seen in some of the classrooms. So you could build on that. That sounds like a great thing for the future.
Well, one thing I did do, I'm involved with a group called Kids Growing Food, which is out of Cornell. And in fact, they were giving away a copy of How Groundhog's Garden Grew to all the teachers who went through their program. And so I went to a couple of their schools, the Kids Growing Food schools, where they had put in these really amazing gardens, and I was just so excited.
Oh, okay.
And there are a lot of them around Ithaca. Yeah, I think you can either go to my website, and there's a link to Kids Growing Food, or you can just Google Kids Growing Food. They give out grants, too. They give out grants to plant gardens and to teach teachers how to integrate it into the curriculum.
Mm. So one of your concerns is also nutrition.
Oh, yeah.
I would take it. Me, too. It's amazing. It's amazing the kind of foods kids are still eating in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how much nutrition has to do with health. I mean, it just totally has to do with health.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which book of yours is your favorite? Do you have one?
Oh, it's always such a hard one.
The most pleasure working on, perhaps?
I think that the great kapok tree is probably... I mean, I have to say it's one of my favorites because it's everyone else's favorite.
It's great. I read that as soon as I knew you were going to come on the show.
Hmm.
Yeah, I got it from the library.
I didn't really understand the power of it until I saw it performed as a ballet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then everyone around me at the end, they're all sniffing. You know, like
who translated it into a ballet?
Sort of choked me up. It was a private school in Fort Lauderdale, and it was a performance that could have been at the Kennedy Center. It was so good.
Did they have to get your permission to do that? Did you take part?
No, I just sat in the audience, watched it, and I was so impressed.
Wow,
just so impressed.
Amazing.
Beautiful music. There was another school in Michigan that put a play on, and beautiful music and choreography. No, it's kind of amazing what they're doing, what they can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish that a place like Kennedy Center would put it on, you know, so on the big stage, because it really is. I found that when I was once removed from it like that, then I could actually experience the full effect of the book, and it made me cry.
It was almost like seeing it new.
It was like seeing it new.
I would never have thought of that as a ballet. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your future projects. I hear that you're writing a book about the Redbud Woods issue.
Yeah, now that's back burner because I have all these other ones to do.
Uh-huh,
but when I was trying to save Redbud Woods, I did mentioned that I was working on that book, A Walk in Redbud Woods, and I think it would be a fitting memorial to that woods that it is no longer. Yeah.
Yeah. That was such a tragedy that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it just broke so many of our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
It was so unnecessary.
Yep.
I fully believe that it was absolutely unnecessary.
I think so, too.
Yeah. So what's coming before that in Lynn Cherry's creative life?
I'm doing the Citizen Science book, the Ira Bill Woodpecker book, and I'm actually going to Australia next week for 3 weeks. I'm researching a book on the oceans, a history of the oceans. It's sort of like a history of the oceans, like A River Ran Wild is a history of the river. And it ends with, the oceans book ends with the marine protected areas, the creation of marine protected areas. And Australia is really ahead of the whole world in setting aside these reserves so that fish have a place to grow up, you know, reproduce, get big. And so I'm going to a marine protected area conference and then to the Great Barrier Reef. So that's I think that's going to be an important book because we are, our oceans are really in trouble between climate change and overfishing and then these trawlers which actually destroy the whole substrate. Any place where the fish could actually have a nursery, you know, have, lay eggs and have them survive. Yeah.
Mm. What is your focus besides the books in regard to some of the most important environmental issues in the near future?
Well, I'm really lucky because I think the books actually tie me in to these issues. And as I said, you know, I choose a book depending on what I think is sort of the most important things that kids should know about and what they can, where they can have a positive effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I haven't written about is global climate change. I tried writing this book, and I just felt it was too bleak.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Prospect. Yeah, there are things kids can do, like you know, they can try and get their parents to not buy an SUV and lobby for better laws for auto emissions, things like that. But those really are more adult issues, I think, mm-hmm. or for older kids. Yeah. So what was the question?
I was just wondering what you thought were some of the major issues for the future in regard to the environment. And we are running out of time, so.
Okay. The major issue is climate change. The major issue is global climate change. Mm-hmm. It's changing where animals can live. It's changing the currents. It's changing the weather patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I think of everything, that's what I fear the most. And I think we really have to lobby our politicians like immediately.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I needed to mention was when I was on this radio show talking about the mangrove book, I got a call from someone who wanted to tell me about the mangroves in Bimini. And I went to Bimini and saw these mangroves and fell in love with them. And they are, mangroves are just essential as nurseries, as fish nurseries, as buffers, as coastal buffers, and as habitat. And these mangroves are being destroyed by Conrad Hilton. On the website, I have information about how to write to Conrad Hilton.
Mention your website and your contact information.
Okay. My website is simply my name, lynncherry.com. So it's LYNNE, cherry like the fruit with no space in between, .com. And if you click on books and then click on the title of the mangrove book, it will bring you into a page that tells you all about mangrove issues and has all the addresses of the Hilton, the people at Hilton who you can write to ask them to please stop cutting down the mangroves on Bimini.
Thank you for being with us, Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.